Where do you turn for all the latest in medical and nursing research? How do you stay up to date and know what's good science or bad science? Well, we're going to have an interview with a nurse and a doctor who have a podcast that does just that. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show, our podcast for nurses by nurses. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to take this opportunity, as always, to thank you for checking out the program this week. We've got a good show for you. I have the hosts of the excellent research podcast called The Medically Clear Podcast on the show this week. We'll be talking about topics they've covered recently on their show and what you can do to stay more up to date on current research using their podcast. We'll have that and more later on in this episode coming up. Before we get to that segment, though, I do want to make sure that you are doing a couple of things. You need to follow up on what I'm talking about in the show so that you understand what to do with it and how to apply it. And you can do that by heading over to nursingshow.com and checking out the links in each episode's show notes. There are articles there and other resources as well. There's a link to our free Nursing Show mobile app. There's tips for student nurses, a lot of stuff. But make sure you're following up so you know how what I and my guests talk about each week is applied using your own nursing scope of practice. If you want to get back in touch with me, maybe you have a question or a comment, drop me an email. Send them in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I love to hear from you, and I make sure I respond back to all those emails that come in. So you can send me all kinds of stuff. Send me links to interview ideas that you have, topics for future episode. Whatever the case may be, I want to hear from you, so please keep them coming. Also, I want to give a special thank you, as always, to Physio-Control for being my overall sponsor for this episode. You can find out more about what they're up to at physio-control.com. And check out the links to all of my supporters over at nursingshow.com, and they'll be available in the show notes for the episodes as well. That's it. I'll have some more contact info coming up later on, but let's go ahead and get on into this week's special segment about the Medically Clear podcast coming right up. First up in the news this week, I have a look at a special eye exam awareness interview I did recently. You know, when it comes to seeing clearly, the path to better sight has become the latest battleground for mobile health versus traditional methods of examination. An in-person eye exam is key to checking on several chronic health conditions that might be missed otherwise. I chat with Dr. Howard Purcell in this news segment about eye exams and what nurses can do to help their patients to remember to check on their eye health frequently.
Morning, Jamie.
Hi, Dr. Purcell. I want to welcome you to the Nursing Show. This is a program for nurses by nurses, so we have a lot of people that interact with kids and people of all ages. And I know, at least in the school setting, nurses are often very quick to, or often some of the first people to recognize that people have sight problems. So I'm really interested in getting into this interview. First off, I was intrigued by the thought that there is an online eye exam available out there. Can you tell us a little bit about how this came about?
Sure. You know, Jamie, the idea of having an online eye exam or having technology affecting the eye exam is probably not that surprising. I mean, let's face it, technology is literally affecting every aspect of our life. But I think it's important that we talk a little bit about probably more about what the online eye exam can't do as much as what it can do. And very quickly, if just a little history around what the eye exam is, right? The eye exam is really made up of two components. It's the refractive component. I'm sure many of your nurses know this. Assessing the power of the eye. What is it, the correction? What's the prescription that's required to give that child or that adult the best vision they can have? But that's only one component of the eye exam. Another, you could argue, more important component of the eye exam is assessing ocular and systemic health. That's a component that, at least today, the online so-called eye exam, which would really be best suited to be called the online refraction, is unable to do. And that's the concern that most practitioners, medical practitioners, nurses, doctors have, is that the average consumer isn't going to necessarily know that. So they're going to come on, they're going to do this refractive component, and if all goes well and they can see okay through that, perhaps make an assumption, my eyes are healthy. But yet there is no health assessment that's been been completed. A comprehensive eye exam includes both of those things. Let's face it, one day we probably will be able to go online and get a comprehensive eye exam. But I think it's critically important your listeners and their patients understand today is it's not that. Think about the first cell phone. It had some capabilities, but it certainly wasn't capable of doing the things it's able to do today. I would say that's a reasonable analogy for what we can do with online refraction today. And at best, that online refraction can handle the pretty straightforward, simple cases of people probably 45 and younger. That's at best today. But it's exciting, it's interesting, and I think we should all keep watch on it to determine what and when it will get to a point that it will be able to do the comprehensive exam. Because in that case, you can imagine we could reach people that perhaps we wouldn't be able to reach because of remote locations, because of funds, because of their abilities to be able to get to an eye doctor. So it has some great potential. We should keep watch on it. But today, it's not the answer.
Yeah, I agree. And I know of, you know, I have a daughter with rheumatoid arthritis, and she has to go in and get her eyes checked for the inflammatory reactions that might be going on there. What are some of the other diseases and disorders that can be caught through a comprehensive eye exam?
Well, you know what? The eye exam itself is enabling us to look at both the eye and systemic disease. So first of all, most diseases affecting the eye, as you know, have minimum to no really real symptoms. By the time you feel symptoms of things like glaucoma and other eye diseases, they're so far advanced they become much more difficult to manage. So that's a key component to it, is understanding that the eyes, you don't get a lot of pain from the eyes. There's not a lot of blood in the eyes. So it doesn't really always give us that clear indicator that things aren't going well. So as a result of that, it becomes critically important to have that comprehensive eye exam. Now, another key component is what we're able to see when we look in the eye. What many people don't understand, and I know your nurses do, but we need to make sure more people understand, in the back of the eye on the retina, we have some of the smallest blood vessels in the entire body. And when we think about it, when systemic disease affects us, things like diabetes, hypertension, very prevalent diseases in our society, unfortunately, those diseases first are not going to affect the carotid artery, are not going to affect the aorta. They're going to affect some of those very tiny blood vessels, by the way, found in your kidneys and in your eyes. A little tough to open up your kidney and take a look at those functioning, pumping blood vessels, but candidly pretty easy to look directly in the eye at pumping, functioning blood vessels, where some of the first signs of systemic diseases like diabetes and hypertension are likely to happen. So it just makes sense when we look in the eye, we're looking at ocular health. Is the eye healthy? We're looking for signs of cataract, or we're looking for signs of glaucoma, for any other diseases or any other manifestations of diseases that come from wearing contact lenses or treating the eyes inappropriately, et cetera. But importantly to add is that opportunity to really look at general health. And that's something that I think isn't always communicated well, and it's an important component. Those annual eye exams are really critically important, both for adults and children.
So annually is what you're recommending for everyone. Is there a group of people that maybe need more frequent eye exams?
Great question. So let's start with kids. For our kids before age one, so from birth to age one, they should have an assessment. That's not a comprehensive eye exam, but really enables us to determine, are the eyes progressing appropriately, are going through the necessary stages of development in the appropriate manner? And that's something that can be assessed candidly pretty easily. Then we want to get the eyes examined before entering school. And that becomes a critical component as well. So at those two times. Otherwise, we like to say annually. Now, look, here's what can happen, Jamie, and you know this well. You go into your eye doctor's office and they say, Jamie, you know what? You were in last year. I looked at you this year. You have no high risk factors. Your eyes look healthy. You know what? Let's go 18 months to 2 years. That's a decision you and your practitioner should be able to make together. But we think it's easy to let people know, let's get those eyes examined annually, particularly at times where things are critical, like for our children and when we reach 40 to 45, when our eyes are changing. And then if our practitioner decides we can go longer, that's great news. We can postpone for 18 months, perhaps 2 years. But that's an individual decision that has to be made. By the way, it is Eye Exam Awareness Month and Children's Eye Health and Safety Month, so we're really excited to get a chance to make sure when those parents are putting their list together of here's the things preschool before before we get to school we're ready to do, we want to make sure that eye exam is at the top of that list. That's critically important because keep in mind, if we don't have good vision, how are we ever going to reach our full potential? We want to make sure our children don't have an obstacle of vision getting in their way of them reaching their full potential. There are so many other obstacles out there.
Yeah, and I, you know, as a nurse even, I was unaware that I had a daughter with needing glasses until I asked her to read the clock herself and stop asking me what time it was, and she said, I can't see that from here. And I was
shocked. And you're a great parent, and you probably were very observant of everything, but sometimes it's those little subtle things. I'll tell you another thing that I think is important for your listeners to know is that I've seen so many cases where kids have been diagnosed with attention deficits or attention issues. And when we get down to the root cause, oftentimes it's a vision problem. I mean, think about it. Kids sitting in the back of a classroom, they can't see. They're probably not excited to tell everybody, hey, I can't see. So what are they going to do? They're going to start talking to the person next to them. They're going to fidget around. They're going to become disruptive because they can't see. And why not start with the easy stuff? If it's just a matter of correcting vision with glasses or contact lenses, let's do that before we put our kids on medications. I think everybody would agree, and I've seen so many cases where the root cause was purely a vision problem and it was diagnosed as something else. I think our nurses, our doctors can help a lot in making sure we minimize that.
So I always have my audience try to keep a list of great websites where they can refer patients for information rather than going to Dr. Google. So is there a place where people can get more information on types of questions they can have prepared for their eye visit or what kind of things they can expect?
Absolutely, Jamie. So at SLO, we believe in our mission, which is improving lives by improving sight. And we've created a website. Everything from children to adults should be rich with information that they can use and our nurses and doctors can use as well. So the best place to go is going to be EssilorUSA.com. That's EssilorUSA.com. And we also have EssilorPro.com. So EssilorPro.com is going to be more for the professional side. And I know that's more your audience. But for their audience, if they also want to pass on to their patients, both children and adults, a good place for them to access information, that would be at EssilorUSA.com. And I'll give you one more little tip that I think is fun and easy one to remember that helps. Our kids and adults are spending a lot of screen time, 11, maybe 12 hours a day we hear these days. A simple tip called the 20-20-20 rule. Every 20 minutes, take a 20-second break and look at least 20 feet away, so out a window somewhere. The eye's a muscle, right? And that muscle being strained and looking up close 11 to 12 hours a day, it's not used to doing that. Let's give it a little break. Let's let it relax. 20-20-20 rule, a great way to go. Children's Eye Health and Safety Month, let's make sure we get our kids' eyes examined. 1 in 4 kids have vision issues that are uncorrected. We need to address it. And I know you and your audience can help us a lot with that.
Dr. Purcell, thanks a lot for being a guest here on The Nursing Show, and we really appreciate all the information you've shared with us today.
I appreciate it, Jamie. Thanks for letting us share this very important information.
This week on the show, I interview nurse Angela Ballard and her husband and ER doc, Dustin, about their excellent podcast, Medically Clear. Their show, available in iTunes, is a look at current medical research in an effort to find the truth and expose bad science in the news. So check it out. Coming right up. Hi, Dustin and Angela. It's great to have you both here on the show, here for The Nursing Show. And I'm really excited to talk about your podcast, Medically Clear. It's a great concept, looking at the new medical research and information that's out there and helping people find good topics and good research information when they're looking for it.
Thanks. We're really happy to be here. And we love your show. And we love how you encourage nurses to get involved in research, too.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jamie.
So before we get started, why don't we start with you, Angela, and then Dustin can have a turn. Just tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, what you do and how you got started thinking about doing a podcast.
Well, I'm a registered nurse. I'm also an emergency medical technician, and I'm a medical writer. And we both felt that there was sort of a void out there in helping the average person or a healthcare provider who doesn't necessarily have time to delve into the research, to really understand medical research and to, you know, help find like the best studies out there and really be able to talk to them talk about them with our patients.
And Dustin?
Yeah, I totally agree with Angela there. I am an emergency physician and a researcher. I'm also involved in an EMS on a local level as well. But I think Angela and I are a bit unique in that we actually like to read the medical literature and understand it. And in doing so, and there are some particular publications to this effect, really, and many people know this, there is actually a lot of garbage out there that gets published. Just look at the Wakefield study in The Lancet and the vaccines cause autism spiral that it started. And if you looked at the science from the very beginning, you would be skeptical, but people didn't do that right off the bat. It took a long time. So because we have an interest and we actually like doing it, we feel like this was something that we could provide as a service to listeners, whether they be in the lay public or in the medical fields.
And that was the question I was going to ask you next was, is this podcast primarily focused at the healthcare professional, or is it focused towards the community, or a combination of the both?
It's a combination. So it's people who are interested in improving their own health or improving the health of their patients in a really scientific way. And we see the flashy headlines on the news about the study says this, study says that. But, you know, you have to be a little careful about which of these studies you're going to actually put into your day-to-day practice. And that's what we want to help people be able to do.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, we have noticed, and I would say I was in this category myself for quite some time, that even people in the medical field, they may be well-educated on skills or on particular nuggets of information, but many of us did not get good training as to how to look at the medical literature. So there really is a lot of crossover there. And I know that, you know, many would say you have to have a very specific audience in mind for a podcast, but we do feel like that ours could cover really a broad swath of people. But I would imagine there really are more sort of medical professionals that will be listening to it, because it does affect them more on a day-to-day basis as to what type of literature they want to incorporate into their practice.
Yeah, and I know as far as from nursing, the nursing standpoint, you know, we are taught to look into nursing research and try to get involved at least in some aspects. But there aren't that many programs out there, Angela, that teach nurses directly to do the research and to read critically into the literature. You know, most programs require a statistics class. But I think there should be another class following that up that takes statistics and applies it to research studies so that you can actually determine whether the study is scientifically valid.
Right. And I think that it's important for, you know, any sort of nurse not to be afraid of the literature published in a medical journal. And if you can read it, and then be able to say to your patients who come to you, you know, I heard about this study in the news. You'd be like, well, you know, that study was only 25 people and it really needs to be replicated. Or that study only looked at, you know, white males of this age. It may not apply to you. And just to be able to think like that when you're presented with questions about research and, you know, be able to tell people, well, let's hold up. Let's see what else comes out in the coming years on this topic.
Yeah, it's something we need to continue to encourage. In fact, I know there have been several occasions in my show where I've actually, and listeners will back this up, you know, I've sat there and had somebody who's a guest on my show make a comment or a statement that leads towards thought that there could be more research on a topic. And I always throw it out there. Okay, who's going to jump on and use this as their next research project as a nurse? Because we need more people to look critically at the way we handle things, especially with the continued push, as we have been doing over the last, you know, decade or two, looking at that science-based approach towards medical and healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. Jamie, I also commend you on, you know, every show that I've listened to of yours, you send your listeners to your website, nursingshow.com, and have them do their follow-up research. Because I think that's very important for anyone that is trying to get their information from something like a 20-minute podcast, that, you know, they should go and they should look at the show notes. They should, you know, look at the paper themselves, or, you know, look at the media, and that way they can cement it in and becomes more permanent in terms of how they can bring it up in the course of conversation with patients or others.
Yeah, it's vitally important that I and everybody, I think, in podcasting that has a scientific approach provide the links to the things they've read, whether it's the article, news item, or a specific research paper if you have it, because I think that you're right. It gives us the opportunity to follow up. I can only touch on the high points of things, and sometimes, it's happened before and it'll happen again, I get it wrong. I misread something or I misspeak during the show, and so it's really important for my audience and everybody's audience to follow up on the information. Don't just take my word for it or your word for it, but listen to what we say and then apply their own critical thought process to it.
And like anything, reading medical studies or the manuscripts that come out in journals, it takes practice. And the more you do it, the more comfortable you become with it and the more you can put things in context. So, I encourage nurses to keep at it. And eventually you'll feel like you're more competent at it.
So what are some of the topics that the two of you have covered recently that you really feel like, this is like my proudest moment as a podcaster, or, something you really felt like you knocked it out of the park and found something that was a unique gem in research?
Well, I'll mention one, and then, Angela can mention as well. But there was a study that came out earlier that we did a podcast in March on this, and it was looking at the avoidance of peanut allergy with early exposure to peanut products. And this is a big deal for me and for anyone working in the emergency medical services or in the emergency department, because when we see these cases of peanut allergy and it's anaphylaxis, that is a big sphincter moment. That's a potentially life or death. And we have plenty of kids in our community that they cannot sit at the table with our children because of peanut allergy or peanut products are completely forbidden from school. But this was a very well done study that showed a massive effect of preventing peanut allergy by just simply exposing children to peanut products at a younger age. And so this was one that we thought had a huge impact in terms of its effect, both immediate in terms of parents and what they do with their kids, but also on medical professionals. So that was one that we were pretty jazzed about, really jazzed about the article more than anything else.
I'll let you go in a second, Angela, but it's funny. I read that study too, and it harkened back to my mother. My mother anecdotally always said that people were trying to keep their babies too clean, that they needed to let them get into things, that she always thought that it supported their immune system in some way, just to be what she called a normal kid. And it's interesting that some studies seem to point to that we're trying to separate and isolate our children far too much from some allergens early in life, and it may be a cause of some of these things.
Right. The hygiene hypothesis, the so-called hygiene hypothesis. Yeah, I think there's a lot to that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And people can look up the hygiene hypothesis. And there's studies about having pets in the home, kids who live on farms, and, early exposure to peanut products. And there's just a lot of research out there on that topic. Of course, we're not encouraging people to start feeding their babies raw peanuts right off the bat. It's definitely a conversation you want to have with your pediatrician about your best approach for your family and your child. But it was a very interesting paper.
So, Angela, you might have had another topic that you found interesting.
Yeah, we looked at a study that came out in Science in May 2015, and it was about how children who've been infected with measles, not only do they go through that illness and the immediate ramifications of that, but researchers found that measles infection actually hurts your immune system for up to 2 years and 4 months after the infection. So, and it's something called immune system amnesia, where the child's immune system actually forgets the previous illnesses it has learned to recognize and fight. And so children who've been infected with measles actually have an increased risk of mortality from another infectious disease, as I said, 2 years, 2 years, 4 months after being infected with measles. So, and as Dustin mentioned, you know, we're still dealing with the fallout from that myth that measles can cause autism, and not measles, but that vaccines can cause autism. And so people who are concerned about vaccinating their children, they need to understand that, you know, maybe your child could get measles and recover, but there is a long-term effect. You know, they could be harmed further down the road from that sort of infection, and that, you know, a measles vaccine is very important. And actually, the researchers said that the measles vaccine is one of the most cost-effective interventions for global health. And I thought that was a really powerful statement.
Yeah, it's interesting that we've got the fallout from bad research. That's just such a glaring example of why it's incumbent upon researchers to do good research, to really parse their data correctly, because it can have such longstanding repercussions, you know, years and years and years later. And we're having, you know, there's now research, you know, that we've seen recently that says that we're not having any effect positively to combat this anti-vaxxer movement as healthcare professionals, that we're having trouble convincing parents that are against vaccines to get their children vaccinated. So there's research that's, you know, showing how we're not being effective at this.
Yeah, it is discouraging. And, you know, this article came out not long after the measles outbreak. And we had some cases here in the Bay Area of actually natural immunity parties where parents took kids who had measles and they brought them over and had them mixed around with some other unvaccinated kids so they could get natural immunity. And so what this paper, which by the way was done by a medical student at Emory and had, I don't recall exactly how long the supplement was, but it was about 40 pages of supplemental analysis. So a very in-depth analysis. You know, this paper essentially says that by doing that, you are putting your children at risk for another 2 years that they could get another horrible infection like a strep infection or meningitis because their immune system is not going to be as strong. So natural immunity is not always better.
Yeah, I mean, this practice really refers back to a time before there were vaccines readily available and parents tried to control not the immunity of their children, but the timing of the infection. So that it was convenient for the parent. I remember my mom having me play with a neighborhood kid so that I got chickenpox while I was on summer vacation because she didn't want me to miss school.
right.
You know, but it was not to help my immune system. It was because it was more convenient for her. And this was, of course, before there was a chickenpox vaccine. So, you know, it was, you know, it's just difficult for why people come up with these ideas and thoughts based on, you know, archaic practices.
Right. I mean, it made sense for your mom because there was no prevention. So you might as well get the chicken pox when you're not in school and when she knows that you can deal with it. But and in the summertime where your risk of having a secondary infection is less, it made a lot of sense back then. But in this era of highly effective and safe vaccines, you know, I don't think that any of us or very few of us in the medical profession would say it makes any sense to do anything like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And it kind of goes back to what we hope to accomplish with our podcast is by teaching people to, you know, critically think about the studies they see come out. Like, you know, if a bad study gets published and people start believing it, we have a really hard time, as this anti-vax movement shows, getting that back, that information like retracted and getting people to believe it. So if we could all start out at a higher level in reading studies and, you know, if it's a bad study, not believing it from the get-go, as opposed to letting it get out of hand like this one has.
Yeah. I do think, though, that, you know, Jamie, you are right about sort of the evidence that it's hard to convince people in the anti-vax movement to change based on evidence alone. And, you know, we had Art Kaplan, who's a bioethicist, on our show to talk about that. And, you know, the idea that you could actually penalize parents who don't get their children vaccinated, you know, a monetary penalty, or that they could be liable to have a legal suit filed against them if their child had a vaccine preventable disease and passed it on to someone else. We're not necessarily advocating those ideas, but it is, you know, I think important to start thinking outside of the box on this topic because our approach of using solid science to convince people on the fringe of the issue really has not worked.
And I'm sending my youngest daughter off to college this weekend, and we're in another, sending her to another state. We're used to having my kids have to have all kinds of vaccine boosters and medical records provided to go to college here in Maryland. And yet in Ohio, she doesn't have to have anything. There's no medical requirement for, you know, making sure her measles are up to date. You know, she's going into the most infectious environment since she was a toddler. And she doesn't have to have, you know, the meningococcal vaccine or any of that stuff. Now, we went ahead and provided it because it's recommended, you know, But it's just interesting to see how many states and jurisdictions have such varied approaches to what is required.
Right, absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about where people can find your show if they want to look it up, and maybe some things you have on the horizon. What do they have to look forward to?
Well, so you can find us on iTunes as Medically Clear, the podcast. And you can also email us if you're interested at medicallyclear@gmail.com. And you can get on our mailing list that way. Just tell us you're interested. And the first 100 people who email us can get a free copy of our upcoming book called The Medically Clear Compilation.
Yeah, it's going to be an ebook, Jamie, of essentially short vignettes touching on many of the topics that we have spoken to, and these are columns that have been published in local newspapers and in emergency medicine news, but it will be a compilation, an ebook, short ebook, but it's a quick read, and it's free, so there's that.
And then our next episode of the podcast is actually going to look at implicit bias in healthcare provider education. And we have two studies we're looking at. One is how gender bias favors female nursing students in written examinations. And this is a study coming out of Greece. It's a small study, so definitely more research is needed. But that's one of the things we're going to talk about. And what's that other study, Dustin?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting contrast, and Jamie would like your thoughts on this if you have a moment, and that is that there is obviously this bias in general towards females being in nursing. It's just a historical, not necessarily bias, it's just the way it is, and more males being in medicine, medical doctors. And we found these two studies, one that shows that there is a bias towards more favorable written test evaluations for female nursing students, and another one that was a presentation at the at a major academic emergency medicine conference in New Orleans this past May that showed the opposite in resident, that is, you know, doctors and training evaluations year 1 through 3, where the initial evaluations when they first started were pretty much the same across 23 different subcompetencies, and this is, you know, 35,000 evaluations. But by the time they got to year 3, the males were being consistently ranked higher by their evaluators on all 23 subcompetencies. So that there was some effect, and the subcompetencies are things like multitasking, airway management, skills, knowledge, that sort of thing. So an interesting dichotomy there, and we really think our thought is that this is implicit bias based on sort of what evaluators think should be the qualifications or the qualities of a successful nurse or doctor.
Yeah, I think there's definitely that. And it's one of those things that it's very hard to deal with, because that type of implicit bias is inside us. It's ingrained into us so deeply that we don't even notice it so often. And so it's very difficult to get around that. I know when I went through nursing school, I ran into a situation in our OB rotation where we were, you know, the male students on the rotation had the instructor had to go in and ask the woman if she was all right having a male nursing student watch her birth. None of the female students had to do that. And so we had to actually sit down at a point in our instructional process and say, we feel we're being discriminated against.
Mm-hmm.
And she was horrified. She hadn't really thought about it. She was just trying to be polite to the patient. And we said, well, you know, would anyone else have that same consideration? Would, you know, if we're going to be their nurse, we need to be their nurse. And so I think that it's something that we need to stand up for, both on our own part as a male nurse to battle that implicit bias. But we also, you know, I'm a paramedic as well, and I help train people, and I'm sure there's implicit bias in that realm as well. And so we need to combat this, and that starts with awareness through studies like this.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And so one of the things this study was talking about was whether, you know, should examinations be blinded to people's identities? And, you know, obviously that gets complicated, but there's sort of a negative feedback to male nursing students if they're, you know, sensing this bias against them, you know, whether it's conscious or unconscious. You know, there's kind of the, you know, maybe they'll reconsider pursuing this career. And when we have 90% of nurses being female and only, you know, 10% or so being male, that's not good for our patients. That's not good for the healthcare system in general. You know, things should be more diverse. And so if there's, you know, implicit bias that's, you know, discouraging men from this profession, we need to work on it.
Definitely. Well, I'm going to look forward to that episode, and I'm sure everybody else will as well. So we'll be looking for that. Is there a website that you guys have up that people can go to?
Well, that's a great question, Jamie. We're working on a website, but if people want to email us at the medically clear Gmail address and give us ideas or questions, we do have a Podbean site, and so there is an ability to comment there, but we don't have a specific website. But I see that looking at the nursingshow.com, we have a good model that we can follow as we develop our website.
Well, and I'd be happy to help you along with that process. I've been doing this for a while, and would be happy to help you get yours set up as well.
That would be great. We would really appreciate your advice.
All right. Well, folks, there you have it, a Medically Clear podcast. You can find it in iTunes, and of course, always be able to email them if you want a direct link as well. But, you know, thanks for coming on the show. And you know what? As far as that book goes, when the ebook is out and ready and you have it published, let me know. I'll make sure I share the link as well to my audience through my various social media channels.
Fantastic. That would be great.
Yeah. Thank you, Jamie. It's been great to talk to you.
That's going to close out this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank all of you for checking out the program this week. Make sure you follow up, though, on all of the information you picked up in this episode. Head over to nursingshow.com and check out the episode show notes. There's a link right there at the top of the page. In there are listings for all of the episodes of The Nursing Show. From the most recent one at the top, you can scroll down and go all the way back to the very first episode. But I want you to get the full information there with links to other resources so that you understand how to apply what you hear on the show to your own nursing practice or studies. If you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email. You can send that in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I respond back to every email that comes in, and I want to hear from you. So send me your comments, your questions, suggestions, news links. Help support the Nursing Show community with your input. You can also get the Nursing Show email newsletter. There's a link and form right on the right-hand side of the Nursing Show site, so fill out that short form, and we'll send you the links to each episode's show notes directly to your email inbox each week. You can also connect with me on social media sites. I'm available there under the handle PodMedic, so you can find me there under twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic, so friend or follow me. You can also become a member of the community over on Facebook by liking the Nursing Show Facebook page at facebook.com/nursingshow. Click the like button there and join the conversation on that page. I post other nursing and healthcare articles and pictures on the Nursing Show site throughout the course of each week and over at the Nursing Show page, so check it all out. That's it for me. I'm your host, Jamie Davis. I'll be back with more episodes here of The Nursing Show. Remember, it comes out every Friday for you, so you can wrap up your nursing week. In the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show.